Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Johnny Fasillo running the show again today. 17 years old, in charge of the board. I was waiting for him to point at me to say it was all right to talk, but he's like, "No, you're a professional. You figure it out on your own." Thank you, Johnny, for the what do we call it? Weird? I guess we'll call it weird music. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. Jimmy Akin here with us, and Jimmy collects up these weird questions because people have figured out that they can send these questions to Jimmy and they will get a serious, a considered answer from Jimmy Akin, one that takes them seriously and their question seriously. So we've got a whole bunch more. Just before we went to the break, Jimmy said that, you said, Jimmy, mm-hmm. that Augustus used to say, quicker than boiled asparagus.
Quick as boiled asparagus. It was one of his personal pet phrases and thus part of his idiolect.
And how do we know that? Is it just by people reporting on, like, writing letters about him or something like that?
Yeah, if you read, I believe this particular one, along with a few other of his pet phrases, was mentioned in in Suetonius's Lives of the 12 Emperors.
Oh, okay.
But it's in the Roman history sources.
So it's weird to think of asparagus 2,000 years ago. Like I was saying to you at the break, you get this, like, well, how much has it changed in 2,000 years? Like, would I recognize it as asparagus? I mean, I suppose you'd
recognize it as asparagus. It may have been somewhat different, just like they had grapes in the ancient world, but their grapes would not have been seedless the way ours are, and they wouldn't have been as big and plump, because over time we've used horticulture to improve the qualities of plants that we want them to have. So typically our fruits are much bigger and have more sugar in them than the ancient versions of the fruits did. So modern cultivars are almost always different than the ancient equivalent that it came from, but it should have been recognizable as asparagus.
So he said, quick as boiled asparagus. So here's my question for you. Does asparagus boil particularly quickly, and why would it if it does?
Yeah, so assuming you pick it at the right time, it will boil quickly compared to comparable foods. Now, if you let asparagus go too long, it's going to get really thick and woody. So you want to pick the asparagus when it is not yet thick and woody. You want to pick it when it's more flexible and younger and not as thick. But it would, compared to a comparable food mass of another kind, it would boil quickly. And the reason is because it's long and skinny. To help us understand this, if you think about, you know, pasta, like spaghetti, especially angel hair spaghetti, it's long and thin, but it's made out of dough. You know, it's basically almost all wheat with maybe a few little extra things in there. But if you imagine taking a ball of dough, let's say it weighs a pound, and you shape it into a sphere and set that ball of dough aside, and then you take another ball of dough that also weighs a pound, but instead of shaping it into a sphere, you put it through a pasta maker that converts it into these long, thin hair-like strands like angel hair pasta, and you take both the spherical ball of dough and angel hair pasta and dump them into different pots of boiling water, the angel hair is going to boil much faster than it's going to cook thoroughly. And the reason for that, scientifically speaking, is because the angel hair pasta, by turning it into pasta instead of a sphere, it has much greater surface area for the same mass. They both weigh a pound, but the pasta has much greater surface area than the sphere does. And consequently, if you think about, well, in order for it to cook thoroughly, the heat from the water has to get to the center of whatever shape is being boiled.
Right.
And it's going to take a lot longer for the heat from the boiling water to get to the center of a 1 pound sphere than it is to get to the center of a narrow little strand of pasta. And so because asparagus is long and thin like pasta, it's going to boil quicker than boiling something else of equivalent mass that doesn't have that long, thin shape.
So there's Augustus. He's like, that stuff boils quickly because it's long and thin. And look at that chariot guy. He's quick as boiled asparagus.
Yeah.
That's how he, that's what he would say.
And the chariot guy will pay you on Greek kalends.
Okay, now you got to help me with what does that mean? I don't know. I think 75% of those words, I don't even know what they are.
Greek kalends. Yeah. So they didn't number, they had in Roman timekeeping, they had months, but they didn't number the days of the month the way we do. Mm-hmm. Instead, they had different periods within the month. For example, one of them, you know, what Julius Caesar was told.
The Ides of March.
His assassination, beware the Ides of March. Well, the Ides were sometimes what we would call the 13th of the month and sometimes what we would call the 15th of the month. The beginning of the month, though, was the kalends. And so the beginning of the, another of Augustus's pet phrase was that someone would pay you on Greek kalends, because kalends was part of the Roman timekeeping system. It was not part of the Greek timekeeping system. They didn't use it. And so there was no such thing as Greek kalends. And consequently, Augustus meant you're never going to get paid by that guy.
That I've always suspected that that is also the meaning of when someone says, I will gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today, that I don't think you're going to get paid on Tuesday.
Oh, that's such a wimpy answer.
All right, off we go to the questions again. Weird questions with Jimmy Akin. Joe wants to know, why is there no gospel according to Jesus? Or why is there nothing written attributed to Jesus?
Well, in regard to the first question, why is there no gospel attributed to Jesus? Because he didn't write one. He preached orally, and he commissioned his 12 apostles to learn his message and then preach it themselves. So there was no mandate for them. He didn't mandate them to write scripture. Some of them later chose to, but he didn't mandate that, and he didn't do it himself. We do have evidence indicating that he knew how to write, because in the Pericope Adulterae, where the woman caught in adultery is brought before him, Jesus is writing on the ground with his finger. He also knew how to read, which we know from Luke's gospel, where when he visits Nazareth, he's given a copy of the scroll of Isaiah to read, and he reads from it. So he did know how to read and write, but he just didn't choose to write a gospel. That's not what he was about. He let other people learn about him and his story, and they could preach it, and then later they could write it, but this was not something he was doing himself. He had other things that he was focused on during his brief 3-year ministry. Also, the highlight of his ministry is his crucifixion, so how is he going to write about that if he's writing a gospel himself? I mean, when you got your arms nailed up, it's kind of hard to write.
Yeah.
So, you know, that would be left to someone else naturally. On the other hand, with regard to the second question, why is there nothing written attributed to Jesus? That's not true. There are written things that are attributed to Jesus. Now, many people will, for example, claim to have private revelations where they take dictation from Jesus that is meant to be written down and given to others. You know, and most of those are probably not authentic. But there is even an early Christian claim that goes way, way back that does attribute a written document to Jesus. This is the story of King Abgar of Edessa. And so Edessa is a neighboring kingdom to Judea. And according to this story, one of the first century kings of Edessa named Abgar had a disease, and he wrote Jesus. And he'd heard about Jesus as a miracle worker, and he's a king. He's got this disease. So he writes to this famous healer and says, you know, I've got this disease. Could you come and heal me? And by the way, I hear you're having some trouble with the Jewish authorities, and you're welcome to live here. I'll give you a safe place. Well, getting a safe place and not going to the cross and not redeeming mankind was not part of Jesus's plan. So he said, no. But according to this story, he wrote a letter in which he, you know, like thanked King Abgar for his invitation. And he said, I'm not able to go right now, but I'll eventually send you one of my disciples to cure your disease. And he later did after the crucifixion. And we have a copy of the claimed letter from Abgar and a copy of the claimed letter from Jesus. And this is really early. This incident is recorded in, I think it's book two of Eusebius's Ecclesiastical History, which was written about the year 320. So sometime within the first 300 years of church history, this story passed into popular, culture in the Christian world. And Eusebius says that this is actually found in the archives at Edessa. If so, I mean, it could have been salted in the archives at an earlier date, but it is something early that is attributed to Jesus as a written document.
All right. So, yeah, because that's the way he asked it. Why is there nothing attributed to Jesus? And there we have it from even the early days of the church. Thank you very much, Joe. I got to go to the break. Yeah, we'll take a quick break. Right back with more weird questions. It's good to go with Jimmy Akin right after this.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
Hi, this is Father Mike Schmitz. Please join me for Ascension's Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year here on EWTN Radio. We're going through the entire Bible and the Catechism in 365 days. If you've ever wanted to understand what it means to be Catholic and allow those truths to shape your life, this is for you.
Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz. Tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. A whole bunch of weird questions. But they come all the time for Jimmy, so Jimmy collects them for us, and we do these shows from time to time. This question comes from Joe. I beg your pardon. I just did the question from Joe about the writing of Jesus. Mark asked this: could there be aliens, intelligent species from a distant planet, enjoying eternal life in heaven? If there are intelligent aliens living on other planets, do they have guardian angels?
Well, so the first question begins with the word could, and could means, is it possible? So is it possible that there are aliens enjoying eternal life in heaven? Sure, it's possible. I don't know that there are aliens, but, scientifically, it would seem that there are likely to be some. And if there are some, now the faith perspective doesn't have anything to say about you know, do aliens exist? We, God hadn't told us. But if they exist, then they're other children of God. They may be good children, they may be bad children, but they're other children of God. Some of them may not go to heaven, though, even if they're totally, suppose they're an unfallen race. Well, according to scripture, if our race had not fallen, we would have access to the tree of life, which symbolizes the means of immortality. And so we wouldn't die, and thus we wouldn't go to heaven. We'd live in a paradise on earth. Well, if God gave the same deal to another race that he gave to ours, and if they didn't screw it up the way we did, then they wouldn't die. They would just continue to live in a paradise on their own planet. So they might not go to heaven for that reason. On the other hand, suppose their entire race did fall and fell hard the way demons did and didn't repent. Well, then they wouldn't go to heaven for that reason. Or suppose God's will for them is different than us in that their fate is not resurrection. Suppose that God chose to maintain them as immortal spirits. They might not only go to heaven, but remain in heaven forever. Or God could have other plans for another race. We can't, you know, say anything about them since we don't know anything about them, but these are some of the possibilities of what God could choose to do. So is it possible that there could be aliens in enjoying heaven? Yeah, it's possible, but there are other options too. The second question is, if there are intelligent aliens living on other planets, do they have guardian angels? Well, this isn't an is it possible question. I think it's possible for aliens to have guardian angels, especially if they have something they need guarding from. But if they don't have anything they need guardian angels for, they might not have guardian angels. And so consequently, I would have to say, I don't know. It's possible that they have guardian angels. It's possible they don't have guardian angels, especially if they don't need guardian angels. But since this is an up or down yes or no question, I have to say, I don't know.
Mark, thank you very much for the question. This one comes from Denise, who asks, do dogs remember their previous experiences? I have a foster dog that was rescued from a hoarding situation. Now he is safe and well cared for, but I worry that he remembers being hungry and lost.
Well, okay, so let's answer the basic question. Do dogs remember their previous experiences? Yes. To a significant degree. Now, humans don't remember all of their experiences. So, you know, and human memory works in such a way that past hurts fade with time. You know, I mean, I know there were times in my childhood that I was bullied and in pain, and I don't even remember those times. You know, so, you know, time heals all wounds, as they say. And given that dogs are kind of like children in that they are very focused on the now and the present, and they're excited about that, and they experience time quicker than we do. You know, you notice as a child, summer seemed, you know, really long, and now as adults, summer just flies by. Well, we perceive time differently at different points in our lives, and my suspicion is dogs are more like children. They're very focused on what's happening in the now, and they don't have a sense of lengthy periods of time the way we do, which means they're likely to have a lot of things just kind of go by them that they don't remember. So the dog may not remember being hungry and lost in particular, but dogs do remember experiences. I have multiple lines of evidence for that. I mean, there is the fact that, well, you can train dogs, you know, and training requires memory of previous experiences, the training experiences. That doesn't mean, though, that they remember the training as distinct events. There's a phenomenon that humans have where there's a difference between autobiographical memory, where we remember specific events, and things we've been trained to do. I've learned multiple forms of dance, and I know how to do the move because it's in what's sometimes called muscle memory, but I don't remember specifically being taught the move. Normally, I don't have an autobiographical memory of the training moment. And the same thing could be true with dogs and tricks. They may know how to do the trick, you know, like shake or whatever, but they may have no memory of how they learned to do shake. But they definitely do have some autobiographical memory where, for example, my sister used to have a dog that was 7/8 Siberian Husky, 1/8 Wolf. Her name was Lock Anna Rudaba because my sister likes giving dogs and children creative names. Lock Anna Rudaba was known as Lock for short. And one of the things my sister told me is that that she had a particular friend who would come over, and she and her friend would go hiking together. And every time her friend would come over, she and her friend would go hiking together, and they'd take Locke with them. And so Locke came to expect, I see this friend, that means we're about to go hiking. And one day, the friend came over for a different purpose. And so they were not going hiking, and Locke was so confused. But her reaction to expecting hiking whenever this friend came over would suggest that she had memories of hiking with this friend previously. My sister's current dog, Luna Meteora, but Luna, also displays signs of autobiographical memory. For example, I sometimes care for Luna, and I will play games with Luna. Like I have these little squeaky toys there. It's like a little rubber circle. It looks kind of like a biscuit. I think of it as a squeaky toy, but my sister calls it a biscuit. And one of Luna's favorite games is catch the biscuit. And so all I have to do is when I'm taking care of Luna is get one of the biscuits out of the drawer and squeak it. And she knows we're going outside to play catch the biscuit. And that would suggest she remembers previous occasions of catch the biscuit. Also, I noticed once, sometimes I'll sit on my couch and let Luna snuggle with me, and I'll pet her and stuff like that. Well, one day my sister came over to help me with a home improvement project. And so my sister and I are working on the home improvement project, but Luna wants to relate. And so she like hops up on the couch and she's like, here I am. You can come over and let me snuggle you. And that would suggest she remembers autobiographically previous occasions of sitting on the couch with me. So dogs do display evidence of autobiographical memory, but that doesn't mean that, Denise, that your dog remembers being hungry and lost and so forth. Dogs' memories are not as good as human memory in all likelihood. And so if a human like me can forget the details of being, you know, bullied and stuff as a kid, your dog can forget it too. So I wouldn't feel unduly sad about that. The important thing is your dog does know that they're safe and well, and that they're being cared for, and that you love them, and that's what's important. They're not dwelling on the past. That's one thing dogs pretty much don't do.
Thank you, Denise, for the question. Let's go to Steven now. We've got time for Steven's question. Steven wants to know,
this is easy.
Could there be an alternate universe or dimension where 2 + 2 = 5? Is that a mathematical truth that only applies to our universe?
So the answer, as the question is phrased, and interpreting the words according to their normal meaning, the answer is no. There is no universe where 2 + 2 = 5. That's true by definition. And God can create anything as long as it doesn't involve a logical contradiction. But the idea that 2 + 2 = 5 does involve a logical contradiction. And so God could not create a universe where the laws of mathematics, which are true by definition, could be different. Just like God couldn't create a universe where a bachelor is something other than an unmarried male, because that's what a bachelor is by definition. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't play with the situation and try to come up with universes that sound like that. Like maybe in another universe, they just use the word bachelor different. Maybe they use it to refer to a married man. Okay, but you've just changed the definition of the word. And, you know, yes, God could make a universe where the word bachelor meant an unmarried man, meant a married man, but you're bending the language there. You're not referring to what we refer to as bachelor. You're referring to something else. It's just a different use of the word. And in the same way, you could come up with a mathematical system where 2 + 2 = 5, but it would involve revising the definitions of terms. Like, what does addition mean? Maybe it means summon up the two components that are named in the equation and an extra element. So 2 + 2 = 5, 2 + 3 = 6, 2 + 4 = 7, and so forth. But then you've redefined what addition is. You could also imagine a situation where God, let's say you've got two apples and you put them together with two more apples and boom, God creates a fifth apple. Yeah, but that's not 2 + 2, that's 2 + 2 plus God creating something new. So if you leave all the terms with their normal meaning, 2 + 2 = 4 and not 5 is a universal truth across all universes.
Thanks, Stephen. Right back with more Jimmy Akin, Weird Questions on Catholic Answers Live. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit jimmyakinpodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Back to Catholic Answers Live on this Friday afternoon in Southern California. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's weird questions for Jimmy Akin. We've got a whole bunch of them. This one comes from Audrey, and Audrey asks this. I suspect I know the answer, but in some fantasy genre systems of magic, in particular, I'm thinking of the works of Tamora Pierce, which are aimed at young girls, magic is described as a natural born talent, which involves being able to engage your personal energy to achieve desired results like healing, transfiguration, etc. It is specifically mentioned that only some humans can do this, and the ability is from birth. So no involvement of demons or other supernatural figures. Of course, this talent can be used for evil like anything else. If, however, magic like this was a God-given talent, Would it be licit to use this talent for things like healing on recognition that this is God working through you?
Okay. So the question involves several dimensions. One of them is, I guess the first thing I'll mention is this is actually something that's a version of this is actually believed in some parts of the world. In Africa, Sykele, you may occasionally hear stories coming out through the press about witches and witches being persecuted in Africa and believing, you know, it's believed that they cause problems for the community and stuff like that. And that suggests something to our ears that is not actually what's happening, because they're conceptualizing of witches differently than we do. We think of a witch as a person who has learned an ability to do magic and then uses it, you know, typically for destructive purposes.
Okay.
But they have a distinction. At least this is how it works in the translation in anthropological literature. They have a distinction between what are called witches and what are called sorcerers. A sorcerer is what we think of as a witch. It's someone who has learned magic as a craft. What they think of as a witch is kind of what Audrey is describing, as it's a person who just has this native ability. And they didn't have to learn it. They didn't have to go to Hogwarts or whatever. They just naturally have this ability. And they are believed to typically cause destructive phenomena without even necessarily meaning it. You know, they're not trying to do this. They're like what we would call a jinx. And, you know, if you believe that there are people who are jinxes that are causing destructive effects in your community, you may not want them in your community, and you may take various steps to try to get them out of your community. And thus we hear these periodic stories in the press occasionally about witches being persecuted in Africa. Well, that's the kind of witch they're talking about. It's what we would think of as a jinx.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's kind of similar to what Audrey's talking about here. Now, let's look at this through another lens, which is the terminology that developed in this area during the Middle Ages. There's a distinction in the Western tradition between two different types of magic. And you may think I'm going to say white and black, and no, that is not it. There's a distinction between what is known as ceremonial magic and what is known as natural magic. In the Western tradition, ceremonial magic is where you contact a spirit and get the spirit to do things for you. Like you may contact an angel, you may contact a demon, you may contact a departed human spirit, you could contact God, but you're invoking a spirit to get the spirit to do something for you that you can't do yourself. So that's what ceremonial magic is. Natural magic is different. You don't contact a spirit in natural magic. What you do is you rely on hidden principles of nature, things that are built into nature, either part of human nature or part of the natural world around us, and you rely on them. So that's why it's called natural magic, because it comes out of nature, either human nature or the natural world. But you don't have to invoke a spirit. And so you have this distinction that in the Western tradition between ceremonial magic and natural magic. Interestingly, when Isaac Newton proposed gravity, he got accused of introducing a concept from natural magic into what was then known as natural philosophy. Oh. Today, we call natural philosophy science. So we would classify what Isaac Newton was doing as science. But back then, they called it natural philosophy. But he was accused of this gravity thing. That's magic, because it disagreed with the Aristotelian physics of the day. According to Aristotle, one object could not have an influence on another object unless there was some medium connecting them that would allow the influence from one object to be transmitted to the other. So, you can't hear me unless there's air between us to carry the sound of my voice. It's not like I can just talk with no air, with a vacuum between us and have you hear me. The air is needed as a medium to carry the effect of my voice to your ears, or air plus microphones and headphones and so forth, since we're on the radio. Okay, so for Aristotle, that was a universal principle. In his understanding of physics, there is no such thing as action at a distance. There has to be a connected medium to allow the influence to transmit from one thing to the other. And then along comes Newton, and Newton says, okay, there's this thing, I don't know what it is, but I'm calling it gravity, from the Latin word gravitas, which means heaviness. And it turns out objects can have an influence on each other at a distance without any connected medium to transmit that influence. It can happen across a vacuum of space. One, you know, the sun's gravity can have an effect on Earth and its motions. And people said, well, if you're talking about your newfangled gravity has action at a distance, then that's a concept from natural magic. It would be an undiscovered principle of nature. And it, because it conflicts with Aristotelian physics, and no one had discovered anything that had an action at a distance without a medium. And so, so Newton said, yeah, you're kind of right about that. This is a concept from natural magic. I'm relying on a previously unknown principle or hidden principle in nature. And in terms of a Christian perspective, natural magic, ceremonial magic is problematic. But what was called natural magic, well, if you've genuinely got a principle that God built into nature, there's no reason you can't use it. You could use gravity to, like, put satellites in orbit. You could use electromagnetism to run your iPhone. You could use any number of things that were then considered hidden or occult, like magnets. Because no one had any idea how the influence of a magnet worked. Thomas Aquinas cites magnets as an example of the occult, meaning the hidden. He says there's this hidden virtue in magnets that lets them affect some metals. And he didn't mean it was bad. He just meant man does not know how magnets affect other metals. And so it was hidden, or occultus in Latin. So you could conceivably use natural magic. Now, today, we... In the scientific community, we don't really use the word magic. Instead, we use other terminology, like in the science of parapsychology, psychic functioning, which does, according to the understanding that has developed, normally involve latent or hidden abilities that are hidden in the sense that they haven't been previously discovered in human nature, to do things like heal people, or maybe in some cases harm people. But Audrey mentions healing as an example. Well, if God really built such abilities into human nature, even if they haven't been previously discovered by science, it would be legitimate to use them. You know, if God gave us the ability to, you know, heal someone and they need healing, it would be legitimate to use the ability that God gave us. Now, that'll get complicated if people start calling it magic, because modern people, especially in the Christian community, don't know the history of the term magic, and they assume all magic would be regarded as bad, when really ceremonial magic was regarded as bad. But using previously undiscovered natural principles, you know, of the universe, that wasn't considered bad. So I would say that, in answer to Audrey, that it does not sound to me, like, based on the way she poses the question, that anything morally problematic would be going on here. If someone has a God-given talent to, say, heal somebody or something like that, well, you can use your God-given talents.
All right, Audrey, what a fascinating question. Thank you very much for that. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one, Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul Street Evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Human beings are God's greatest masterpiece. Every person is made in the image and likeness of God. But every saint, that is, every person who accepts God's invitation, his upward call to make them holy. And so every story presents us with a unique masterpiece that God is writing.
The Journey Home, Monday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. How's the call screening going, Edgar? Easy day, huh? Call screening when we don't have any calls. We're just taking, we've already taken the questions from the internet for Jimmy. Weird questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. And I am on Juan now, right? Up next is Juan. Juan wanted to know this. Did Moses eat mushrooms and hallucinate the burning bush?
Well, that's not what Exodus indicates. Exodus indicates that God appeared in the bush and made it burn and not be consumed, and Moses saw this. That's what Exodus says. If you propose that he did something like eat magic mushrooms and then hallucinate the burning bush, you're going beyond what the text says. And this is part of a broader tendency that exists in some circles to do what sometimes is called demythologization. It's also sometimes called euhemerism, after the Greek philosopher Euhemerus. But what it involves is taking something that is of a supernatural nature and proposing a non-supernatural explanation for it. Like, oh, Moses didn't really see a bush that was burning, that would be a miracle, but yet that was not consumed, so that would be a miracle. He just took magic mushrooms and hallucinated. That's one example of an attempt to demythologize the story of the burning bush. Another that I've heard of is, oh, well, there was actually a natural gas leak behind the burning bush, and that caught on fire, and Moses saw the natural gas leak by looking through the bush, and so that's why he saw fire behind the bush and why the bush wasn't consumed, because the fire wasn't actually touching the bush. It was just behind it, and it looked like the bush was burning but not being consumed. So that would be another example of an attempt to demythologize this. What Euhemerus did was he took the stories of Greek mythology and said, okay, they're based on real people who then got exaggerated into being gods at some point. So like there was a guy who used to be, there was a human who was Apollo, and maybe he had a chariot that reflected the light of the sun because it had metal on it. And then that became, oh, Apollo is the sun god and he rides his chariot across the sky every day. And it was another attempt to take the mythology out of a supernatural story. Well, okay, you can propose any explanation you want for what we read. You can propose magic mushrooms. You could propose Moses had, you know, schizoaffective disorder. You can propose Moses saw a natural gas leak. You can propose Moses had a stroke that affected the visual center in his brain temporarily, you know, a transient ischemic event. You could propose aliens came down and use advanced tech to simulate the burning bush. You could propose they took Moses into a holodeck and generated it. You can propose anything you want. You can explain any event you want in numerous alternate ways if you are untethered from evidence and just allowed to speculate. So the question, though, is how good is your proposal? Merely coming up with an idea does not mean we have evidence that the idea is true. And so one needs to remain tethered to the evidence. And we don't have any evidence that Moses ate magic mushrooms. So even though you can propose that as an explanation, we don't have any evidence that that's what happened in this case. The text of Genesis indicates this was a miracle. And I'm a big believer, and I would say we have reason to rely in, you know, on the Bible. And I also believe in the philosophical principle known as phenomenal conservatism, which says that you take experiences the way they appear until you get evidence that they should be taken in another way. So if you have evidence that we ought to take the Bible seriously, and the Bible says Moses saw a burning bush, then I would take that seriously until someone can produce evidence that we should take this in a different sense.
Juan, thank you for the question. And on we go to Felix. Felix says, I have two you can consider. All right, Felix, thank you. Here's the first of Felix's question. Would it be a formal apostasy, heresy, or schism to profess belief in a multiverse and or a simulation hypothesis where an alternate reality exists in which the substance of our divine revelation either never happened or happened in an opposite way, or where our dogmatic facts and moral laws do not apply or apply in the reverse?
No, it would not.
Well, that's okay. So that was a long, convoluted question. So what would not what?
Yeah. It would not be apostasy, heresy, or schism to propose an alternate reality somewhere in the multiverse. The Catholic Church doesn't have any teaching about a multiverse unless you want to consider, you know, heaven and hell alternate dimensions so that we'd have a multiverse with our dimension. But if you propose more broadly, the Catholic Church didn't have any teaching on that, and so it would be a matter of speculation. But speculating that there would be a universe where there was no, where none of our divine revelation happened, well, that wouldn't contradict God's omnipotence. You know, God, as we've said, he can actualize any state of affairs that does not involve a logical contradiction. And so God would be able to create a universe where it's just empty space, or where there are nothing but dead planets, and there's no one for God to reveal, let's say, the Bible to. So God's not required to reveal the what he told us in every possible universe. That's not mandated by the nature of alternate universes. So God could bring it about that there's a universe where he didn't give any public revelation. That's not a problem. Felix then asks, well, what about something happening in an opposite way to what happened here? And in this part of the question, I think it's a little less clear what Felix means, but he cites the examples of moral laws not applying or applying in the reverse. And I think that's also possible, because the moral law is based on human nature. You know, based on human nature, humans need to get married in stable unions to raise their offspring. And so that's us. You know, our offspring are born with freaky big heads that mean, compared to other creatures, that mean they have to fit through the birth canal when they are very immature. You know, they're not like baby deer. You see a baby deer come out, you know, the mother's given birth, plop, here's the baby deer, and within 5 minutes it's up and running around. Well, that's not human babies. Human babies have this freakishly large head that has to get through the birth canal before it gets too big, and that means the overall baby is at a very undeveloped stage compared to other organisms. That means they need intensive care when they are infants, and it takes 2 decades to grow them to maturity. Well, that means that human marriages need to stay together for the sake of the kids for decades, and that's why we have permanent marriages. But that's just humans. If you're an octopus, That's not how it works. The octopi, octopuses, actually, to use the correct English plural, they come together, they do their thing, then the male octopus dies, often killed by the female octopus. Then the female octopus lays her eggs, and she kind of hangs around and blows water over them and stuff to make sure they get the oxygen they need. And then when she sees the eggs get ready to hatch, she dies too. And we actually know it's her seeing them that triggers her death. Because if you blind an octopus, a female octopus, so that they can't see the eggs getting ready to hatch or hatching, the female octopus will go on living. So this is a programmed death reflex in female octopuses. But then once the female dies, those little baby octopuses, they're on their own. You know, their parents do not stay together for years to take care of them. They're on their own after that. So octopuses do not have permanent stable marriages the way humans do. That's not how octopus nature works. Well, okay. So God created us to work one way, but he could create another universe where things work very differently, where he made intelligent beings like us on the octopus model. So that, you know, they wouldn't be humans. They might be super intelligent octopuses, but they wouldn't, to where they wouldn't have, you know, stable marriages the way we do. And he could have made us on the dog model. He could have made us on any number of the intelligent aliens in another universe. He could have made them on any model where their nature is different than ours. And so the laws of morality apply to them differently. To give one example, he could create a species that, in order for a new generation to be born, the previous generation must be killed. Okay, not just must die, but must be killed in order for the new generation to be born. Well, in that circumstance, it would be moral to kill old people. If that's the way this intelligent species nature worked, it would be moral to kill their elderly so that the new generation could be born. That would just be how they're built. It is not how humans are built, and so it's immoral to kill old people, humans, but it wouldn't be for this other race that has a completely different nature. There would be certain moral principles of a foundational nature that would remain the same across the universes, namely the principle of love, because God is love. And so love is going to remain a constant in all morality across all universes. But how that love is expressed, do you care for the elderly or do you kill the elderly, is going to depend on the nature that God has given a particular set of creatures.
All right, I'm going to get Felix's second question real quick. If we are living in a simulation with our physical bodies suspended in a hibernation capsule in the base reality, would our sacraments be valid? What if some of us are AI characters within the simulation and just don't know it? Do we still have a soul?
Okay, so in regard to the overall simulation question, I'm going to recommend an early episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. It's episode 17 on the simulation hypothesis. So you can go to mysterious.fm/17 and get more than what I'm going to be able to give you here. But if it's like in The Matrix, where people have physical bodies that are in pods and they're being fed an imaginary reality, then you could not administer the sacrament of baptism to these people unless if they were in the pod from beginning to the end with no of life, with no contact with another person. It requires another person to be in physical contact with you to baptize you. And so even if they thought they were being baptized in a mental simulation of reality, they would not really be baptized. Somebody, some intelligent being would have to get into the pod in order to baptize the person. Baptism is the gateway to the rest of the sacraments. And so you can't validly receive any of the other sacraments until you validly receive baptism. Now, I could imagine that there might be some sacraments that you could receive if you had been baptized, like matrimony and possibly confession, because both of those sacraments are information-based. The matter of the sacrament in matrimony is the consent, and we can even get married, according to the Catholic Church, by proxy. So you could hypothetically get exchange consent over a telephone or between pods. Something similar could happen with confession. But the other sacraments, unless you're physically anointed by another human or something like that, the other sacraments would not apply.
Thank you for the questions. Everybody who's sending questions, there were lots more. We'll just save those for another day. Felix, thank you for those last two questions that got to us. Jimmy Akin, thank you. I've enjoyed my 4 hours with you today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
The earlier was recording for later this month, so he can hear that on the feast of...
It'll come up quick as boiled asparagus.
Quick as boiled asparagus. All right, that'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.